Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and your calls and emails, questions and answers. So, let's get rolling. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We had some nice emails this week, and I thought I would start off with an email from Kristen in somewhere between Santa Cruz and Scotts Valley. Iron and well water, she wants to know about. My neighbors and I are getting household water from a well. One neighbor recently got a blood panel screening from a doctor that included looking at iron levels. She was told she was over the top with iron and that it was dangerous. My neighbor doesn't even drink the tap water, but I do. It tastes fine. She thinks the iron level of the water is so high that she must be absorbing it from showering. Our landlord gets the water tested 3 or 4 times a year, and the results always come back as acceptable. Let's take a moment and talk about iron. First of all, iron is actually hard to absorb, and particularly in the form that you would find it dissolved in water. It's much easier to absorb as a heme molecule, which is why when you have quote-unquote iron poor blood, they tell you to eat red meat, because the heme molecule is what's found in muscles, and that's actually fairly easy for your body to absorb. But I suspect that your neighbor may have something called an iron storage disorder. And this is a situation where a person actually doesn't get rid of iron easily. They absorb it normally, just like the rest of us, but they aren't able to extract it from their body. The most common form of this is a disease called hemochromatosis. And iron storage disorder is actually a fairly common mutation. It's one that we don't realize how common it is. And a lot of times, as physicians, when we see someone who's got slight elevation in their liver enzymes, we will run that. That's one of the 4 or 5 things we check for. And it's actually comes up, you know, a fair amount of the time. Screening for hemochromatosis is generally done if you have a family history of it, and the prevalence is just not high enough to make screening in the general population worthwhile. Nevertheless, I suspect that that's your neighbor's issue. In other words, something unique to her physiology and not something that you need to be concerned about in terms of your water pollution. Let's go to another email. This from Gary in New Hampshire. I've been diagnosed with fibromyalgia for 10 years. I'm wondering if you can tell me if there any research points to this illness being under the umbrella of dysautonomia. Beyond pain and fatigue, my other symptoms seem to be linked to autonomic nervous system processes. On some days, I'll have unexplained sweating and excessive salivation. On others, I might have heart palpitations and trouble swallowing. Still on others, it might be dizziness and sensitivity to lights. All conventional medical testing in areas related to neurology, cardiology, and endocrine always point to, quote, normal. Parentheses, fortunately, I've lived 32 years before I developed fibro, so I will argue the point that I'm now normal. Anyway, don't know how much attention to the area of dysautonomia has received for illnesses like mine, and whether this has gotten the attention of any functional medicine specialists. Gary, your letter is really good. It raises a number of points. We are always seeking a label, aren't we? Seeking to contain the physical phenomenon of a dis-ease by giving it a disease label that somehow is comforting. Unlike the television program Dr. House, the label doesn't always lead to a treatment. There's not always a handy-dandy drug we can pull off the shelf, but it does somehow comfort us, and I think you are seeking a label here with your dysautonomia question. And I think actually it's a symptom rather than a explanation. I think that fibromyalgia is being understood as a global physiological phenomenon. And its primary source is probably a cellular manifestation, a problem with cellular physiology, particularly in the muscles, particularly in the generation of energy. The other very important energy utilizing part of the body is the nervous system. So it is true that there's an association between dysfunctions or failures in the regulatory loop. I like to think of it as you just don't have breaks, you don't have buffers, you have these wide swings. And that's what you're describing with your symptoms. So that's a label for a symptom. I don't think it's your source. I do think that it points to a strategy for you for helping manage these symptoms, which is to avoid disruptors and seek out therapies which tend to help with stabilization of the endocrine and the autonomic system in particular. And that might be for you acupuncture. And so I would urge you to look around in New Hampshire in your area and see if you can find an oriental medical doctor or a certified acupuncturist, because I think that might help stabilize the symptoms. It's not curative for fibromyalgia, but it's certainly very helpful for symptoms. And let's go now to Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a 75-year-old woman who has a urinary tract infection and is taking, well, she tried Cipro and that didn't work. So then she went on nitrofurantoin 5 days into it, and she has a rash on her back of her legs below the knee. And she says it's coincidental with going to a hairdresser and getting hair color put on her hair, and she intends to keep on taking the nitrofurantoin. So my question is, what is the possibility this, and how bad should the rash be on somebody over someone's body before you should stop taking something like that?
All right. Well, if I understand your question properly, Frank, you're concerned that there may be a drug reaction here.
Yes.
And in general, and of course we're making general statements, drug rashes have a more global characteristic. So they tend to cover the entire body. You often will see them particularly on the trunk. So it would be down low on my list for a rash that was confined to the backs of someone's legs, the backs of their calves, particularly to being a drug rash. So I want to reassure you, it's not 100% for sure, but that doesn't sound like a drug rash to me. The point that you mentioned about going to the hairdresser sort of raised an interesting issue in my mind, because I wondered about a contact dermatitis from the back of her legs coming in contact with maybe a chair or a cushion, maybe when they pulled later back to do her shampooing. And if her legs were bare and against something that had maybe been cleaned or they'd used a plasticizer on it, she could be reacting to a local contact. This is sort of one of the places where you think about contact dermatitis. You also, if someone, for example, develops something and it looks like a glove or it looks like a sock, then you think about contact dermatitis with their detergent or with something else where the wrist and above was protected but the hand was exposed. Things that fit around a ring around the neck. Again, you're thinking in terms of what came in contact with that part of the body. Now, obviously, this is a radio show, so dermatological diagnosis is a little bit beyond my capabilities. But I would think along those lines, and hopefully she will be off of the macrodontin soon. I really don't like people to have to take two antibiotics in a row because it is so hard on their intestinal flora.
So she should get a, what kind of medicine, pill, over the counter, or anything like that, can you get to put the bacteria back in your system?
Get probiotics, which are bacteria that are healthy bacteria. Generally, you can find that at the health food store. I don't usually try to replete probiotics with the commercial yogurts that are available, even the ones that say they have added probiotics. I typically will have people buy a mixed probiotic formula containing at least five different organisms. You want 3 billion of each of five different organisms as a minimum dose, and doing that once a day while on an antibiotic and then maybe a week afterwards is a good way to reestablish the gut flora.
Okay. A general question for people who take antibiotics. I've never heard of anybody dying from taking, you know, getting a reaction from an antibiotic. How bad could the rash be over your entire trunk? People ever get anaphylactic shock
Absolutely. Well, there's two issues there. First of all, absolutely people do get anaphylactic shock and die from antibiotics. There are more people who die from complications of properly administered drugs, either because they have a personal reaction to it or because there's an interaction. But these are where the doctors have not made a mistake. And everybody agrees that this should have been okay, but it wasn't. We lose more people that way every year than we lose on the highways. And we lose a lot of people on the highways. So
it's more likely to be from injection, though, rather than...
Not necessarily. You can have an anaphylactic reaction to an oral antibiotic. And you can also have a very, very severe drug reaction, often called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, in which everything blisters. Your skin blisters, your mouth blisters, the entire intestinal tract blisters. It's a very severe and life-threatening reaction. This can be caused by antibiotics. They shouldn't be used lightly. They're absolutely life-saving when they're used appropriately. But if they're used lightly and a person has a life-threatening complication, then you've just gotten bitten by the risk-benefit equation.
Okay.
Okay. It does not sound to me like it's a problem unless it's spreading. If it's spreading, then it would be advisable for her to stop her antibiotic and seek medical attention. An experienced doctor can take one look at the rash and go, yeah, this is probably a drug rash.
Okay. So generally speaking, though, this has to get pretty bad over the whole body before it becomes dangerous.
I'm not going to make that general statement because sometimes it can become dangerous very rapidly. But I don't think that the rash that she's showing on the back of her calves tells us that she's somehow at more risk.
Okay.
Not unless it spreads.
Okay. Thank you so much.
I hope that's been helpful.
It has been very helpful, and thank you for your help.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. This next from Jennifer in Monterey. I'm writing because I recently discovered that while on a year-long deployment to Afghanistan, my husband has been taking a daily dose of antibiotics as a means of staving off the effects of malaria. Apparently, he and all the other soldiers there are already exposed to malaria, but the antibiotics are keeping it from becoming symptomatic. Four soldiers who stopped taking the antibiotics were diagnosed with malaria. Thankfully, he has had mild digestive issues as an effect. I think she means only mild digestive issues as a side effect. But I wonder what we can do when he returns to get his body back into balance. He has said that he will have to go through a specific regimen of another drug followed by more antibiotics to get the malaria out of his body. His liver, I think he said, once he is no longer at risk of contracting it from the environment. Any suggestions would be greatly appreciated. Well, this is a perfect opportunity to talk about the life cycle of malaria, because this is pretty confusing. You know, if you've gone to a malaria area on vacation, the doctors give you antibiotics to take maybe once a week or maybe every day, depending upon the situation. And then you're supposed to take them for 4 weeks after you get back. And if you've ever tried to give blood a year later, you'll find that, in fact, you're prohibited for 5 years, I believe it is now, from giving blood under those circumstances. You have to have thought to yourself, if you've been in this circumstance, what's up with that? And the answer is, what's up with that is that the malaria protozoan is a very, very interesting organism. And it has to go through two stages to complete its life cycle. It's very, very interesting because it uses both the bodies of the mosquito and the bodies of the human as obligate hosts. If those two hosts aren't available, it can't complete its life cycle. But it does have the ability to sort of asexually reproduce, like a bacteria, dividing, so to speak, until marking time, until it has a chance to actually complete its sexual phase. And that's where this idea of it getting into your liver is concerned. So let me walk you through this. You are bitten by a mosquito that contains the infectious form of malaria. This will circulate in your bloodstream once or twice and then go live in your liver. In the liver, it infects liver cells and it establishes what's called the exoerythrotic cycle. And this is where it can become dormant. Two forms of malaria, not the really bad one, the falciparum, but the Plasmodium vivax and the Plasmodium ovale can be the kinder, gentler, stealth malarias, and they will actually go into a dormant state and sit in the human liver for up to years before they actually reproduce and show any symptoms. When it comes out and out of the closet or out of the liver, as the case may be, it ruptures the liver cell, which has become infected with so many plasmodium that it's very much like a virus infecting a cell and then filling the cells with copies of the virus, causing the cell to rupture. The malaria plasmodium does the same thing. It fills the liver cell, and then the liver cell eventually ruptures, releasing hundreds of the plasmodium form called a schisonct, and then they become this new form. And this new form can do one of two things. It can grow, infect a red blood cell, rupture that red blood cell, make more schisonks, it grow, infect more red blood cells. And that's the circulatory malaria. Every time the red blood cells rupture, you get a big fever. And so it, since it's growing in cycles, it's a cyclic fever, which is our big clue that the person has malaria. What can also happen, and does happen, is that this blood phase, the tropozoite, will actually divide, just like the stem cells in our ovaries and testes, and form gametes, so male and female forms of the malaria. And if you're infected with multiple different genetic lines of malaria, which is typical for people in malaria-ridden areas, then this allows for recombination and sexual reproduction of the tropozoite. It is these gametocytes which are taken up by the malaria, and these male and female sperm and eggs, basically, of the malaria and falciparum, actually mate and reproduce in the mosquito. And then the product of that reproduction climbs up to the salivary glands of the mosquito and reinfects human, and around you go. So when we treat people with prophylaxis, what we're doing is we're trying to prevent the blood phase of malaria. And some people will have a prevented blood phase, but like your husband in Afghanistan, when they come back to the United States and stop the antibiotics, or the guys in Afghanistan who stop the antibiotics, you've no longer killed the blood phase, and so you start to infect your red blood cells, and it amplifies, and you begin to have symptoms. So everything the Army has said is absolutely correct. This is how malaria works. And I thought it would be fun to just think in terms of the incredible degree of complexity and difficulty involved in something like that actually evolving and coming into existence. It's just astonishing. One of the reasons you don't have malaria in more temperate climates is that the mosquito has to stay alive about 18 days. It has to stay alive long enough for the malaria to reproduce itself. This was something I didn't know. So as we have global warming, we physicians in the United States may have to learn a lot more about malaria than we're happy with. Let's go to Ed in Santa Cruz. Hello, Ed, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've got a question about constipation. I'm calling for my significant other who's constipated for about 5 days now, and she's going in for some surgery on first thing Tuesday morning, and she wants to be pretty cleared out.
Is she on pain medication?
She takes one Tylenol with codeine a day.
Okay. That may be the source of the constipation. I've actually used Tylenol with codeine in a pinch as a diarrhea cure, so it can be quite constipating. The first thing to do, standard stuff, is lots of fluid and lots of fiber.
Okay.
Okay. And so fluid and fiber. You said Tuesday, so you probably are wanting to use more of a purgative laxative. This isn't GI surgery, is it?
No.
Okay. And she is a healthy person? She doesn't have a lot of other pharmaceuticals on board?
She takes Septra and Acyclovir.
Okay. She takes Septra every day prophylactically?
Every day, yes.
All right. Which pretty much means that she's going to have pretty disrupted bowel flora. So she might be one of the people that actually would benefit, her constipation would benefit from probiotics. And that's something to think about. But since you've given me a deadline of next Tuesday, that's only 3 days, probably using one of the more purgative laxatives. She could just try taking milk of magnesia. That's a good one. It's non-absorbed magnesium, pretty non-toxic, not a lot of complications, and definitely should get things rolling if you take enough of it.
Okay.
So probably start with something like that, something really basic. Stool softeners are good. There are products that contain Cascara Sagrada. They're sort of my ultimate arsenal drug. I don't like to use those, and I discourage people from using them daily, but they're very good, let's just say, when you absolutely positively have to deliver, then you can use something like that. Everything I've mentioned is over-the-counter.
And what was that last one? I didn't catch the name.
Cascara Sagrada, C-A-S-C-A-R-A. By reading, take your magnifying glass, and you'll find it on the shelf in the appropriate section of your drugstore.
Would a supplement store like they have it, Staff of Life or something like that, have it?
Give them a call and ask.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for your information.
You're welcome, and good luck to your friend and her surgery. I hope everything goes well.
As do I. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Scott in Watsonville. Hello, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
I'm 61 years old. I've got chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I've had it for, I was diagnosed 5 years ago. I've been able to go back in my medical records and see that I've had it for at least 10. It's become extremely symptomatic. The fatigue and weakness are just crushing. I get up off the couch to close the window. I'm winded. I was a horseshoer for many years. I can't even pick up my 70-pound anvil anymore. And there's other symptoms as well. My white cell count got to 129,000, and we started treating the CLL with chlorambucil. And every time we put the chlorambucil, it would just come roaring back. And so a couple weeks ago, I did fairly mild doses of IVGG for the low platelet count I've got, and fludarabine for the CLL.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like my oncologist. I feel very lucky to have them. And there's one issue which he just refuses to discuss, and I respect him on this. He doesn't want to be Dr. Death. And the question is really simple. How much time do I have? I have a 9-year-old son who I'm a single parent, and I have no doubt at this point that this is what I'm going to die of. You got to die of something. He can look at, he can bring out a chart and say, well, most people with this disease don't need treatment for 96 months, you know, but he refuses to pull out that chart that'll tell him what happens to me now. So I understand that the treatment for this disease is only palliative. It does make, I mean, we get the white cell count, the symptoms start to go away. I feel a lot better. But it, my understanding is it doesn't do anything as far as altering the course of the disease. And, you know, I know a lot of people can have it and be asymptomatic and die of something else. I'm not. Apparently, I've had it either long enough or for whatever reason.
Yeah,
become extremely symptomatic.
Well, the number, I'm not an oncologist, so I want to qualify anything I say by saying that I'm not an oncologist. So the number that floats up in my mind for what would be considered a good run after the diagnosis is 15 years. When did you say your diagnosis had been?
5 years ago. It probably should have been diagnosed 10 years ago.
Okay.
That's when I was able to find the first, let's say, 17,000 at that point.
Basically, people become resistant to the drugs eventually. So up to 15 years is kind of like, well, that's about the point where the drugs stop being effective in most people. And there's a huge amount of variability in that, and there's also the possibility that new drugs become available that can be used. But the real question that you're asking me is an unanswerable question, which is how long do I have? Let's play the what-if game, okay?
Okay.
So what if you woke up tomorrow and you were in a crisis and you started to have a hemorrhage or you got an infection? Something bad happened that turned this from a theoretical question into a very immediate question. Who would take care of your son?
Oh, I have a, everyone wants to know. I have that taken care of. A very good friend of mine is going to take over his care.
All right. If you became incapacitated or died as a result of the hospitalization, you've made out a will, your son is as well provided for as you can manage. That's all been done, yes?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because you are effectively responsible for another human being as a single parent, and so that's really your first move.
Yeah. Oh, he is the most important thing in my life. So
you can't really know how long you've got because you're in the situation where it's probably a complication of the disease that will get you, either an anemia or a hemorrhage. or a heart attack because you get anemic and don't realize it, or something like that. Or, you know, I won't drive you crazy by listing all of the possible ways that you may step off, but nobody can tell you how long you have. Every day in your situation, it's true for all of us, but you're in touch with it. Every day is a gift. And you just you just have to take that day and make of it the most that you can.
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult to see it that way when I'm feeling really bad, but I do remember that. And I, you know, do have things in my life that that keep me happy. So
I wish I could offer you more, but that's pretty much the best answer I can give you.
So that was 15 years after diagnosis. You know, is there anything, like, once you start treatment, once somebody's reached the point where you're doing the chemo with them?
The 15 years is, like, the upper end of how long it takes the drug. And people often survive 20 years after diagnosis.
Yeah.
So it's just, if you have anemia, if you have low platelets, that lowers your probability of being a long-term survivor. So it is concerned that you have low platelets.
Yeah.
Do you know if this is T-cell or B-cell?
I'm not sure. I know that, you know, I'm lucky in a sense that I have the least aggressive form of it possible.
Okay, well, I think then you're probably B-cell, which is the one that has the better prognosis.
I think what it's called, it's already differentiated, or I think the bad thing is to have the undifferentiated CLL.
Well, that's certainly true, yes.
You know, I do see my oncologist really quite often now, and of course they do the blood tests, you know, every time. And he is watching all of this stuff, and every so often he does the FISH, the fluoroscopy, I think it is, or something, and checks for mutations. So he's very, very good.
Well, it's good that you have a doctor that you trust and who you believe in. That is a great blessing. Basically, I'm just going to wish you well and say a little prayer for you.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank
you. All right,
you.
I'm a non-believer, but I'll take all the help
you
I
know,
can get.
You know, positive intent, acupuncture works on horses, and positive intention works on non-believers.
Very good, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's talk to Judy in Prunedale. Hello, Judy, and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. My question is, my brother, who's 66 years old, had polio as a child, and he had a very severe case of it, actually, with paralytic polio. And not recently, actually, in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, he's having what they call post-polio syndrome. I'm just wondering, if there, is there nothing they can do for that? Is it just kind of an absolute, or?
Well, post-polio syndrome is when a person has history of polio in the distant past, and what they end up with is a weakening eventually of the large motor neurons in the ventral horn of the spinal column. That's a loss essentially of circuitry that is irreversible. And we are now seeing, we didn't know this before because people didn't generally live long enough after their polio diagnosis until the invention of the iron lung. This is typically something that people had pretty severe polio get.
Right.
And they weaken and eventually become mostly wheelchair-bound, is fairly typical. I have few post-polio patients who've managed to remain walking, but I think of it as kind of a matter of time. If they live long enough, they probably will eventually become too weak in their lower extremities to walk. We don't have therapy for this. This is one of those entities where I feel like we're probably on the brink of something really fantastic with the stem cells, because there are lots of stem cells in the spinal column, lots of rat research, lots of work on people who have transected spinal columns, but regrowing new motor neurons should also be possible along these lines. And it's a matter of time before I think we have new therapies available. But as of today, no, there's not much you can do. And paradoxically, the more you exercise, the faster you seem to lose strength.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. So it's ironic, too, because if you work the muscles, that you make them stronger, but you also work these aging and very overworked motor neurons, and they step out sooner.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the information.
Yes, I'm sorry I don't have a better answer for you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's go to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Constipation, no, hemorrhoids.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I had gastric reflux, so I put the head end of my bed up. And then it was so, I just left it up, even though the gastric reflux kind of went away. But I was concerned about my legs getting the blood sort of pooling down there, and I thought I ought to level out my bed. And then a couple days ago, this internal hemorrhoid in the lower rectum, just like, wow, what is that? It hurts and it bleeds. And so I thought the gastroenterologist receptionist said, yeah, you know, put the foot end of your bed up and do some sit baths. So, yeah, got to level out that bed. Actually, I put the foot end up just a couple of inches higher than my head now.
Are you suffering in general from problems with constipation or straining?
I take pain pills, so I always have constipation. So I always take Ducalax to keep my stool soft. But I'm going to take milk of magnesium and really work on keeping them really soft until this internal hemorrhoid heals.
Yeah, stool softener is also very useful. You almost want to give yourself applesauce consistency poo until that thing heals. They are quite uncomfortable. They're essentially a varicose vein. And most of the time, they don't come from gravity. They don't come from having the foot of your bed down. They come from straining and pushing to poop. And so that's the source, is the internal pressure that you generate, not the gravity flow of your inclination of your bed.
Uh-huh.
So I think you could probably elevate the head of your bed, and I don't actually think it's going to make a big difference with the hemorrhoid symptoms that you're having.
Oh.
You could try it, but I'm not particularly optimistic that your hemorrhoid will feel better when it's above your heart versus when it's below your heart.
Yeah.
Have you noticed such a difference?
Well, last night was the first night I got the head end, the foot end up.
Yeah.
But I've been doing lots of sit baths because I have a wonderful bathtub outside that allows me to just fill it up and have my own hot tub.
That's lovely.
Yeah. Some things are really good, but because of my constipation, I do digitals to get my poo out.
Ah, well, that would definitely contribute to trauma to the area.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, it's better than straining, but it's still definitely something that you need to address, is to get that stool softer and stop straining. You should go online and look up the squatting stool.
Well, I squat all the time.
You do? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Because we really aren't built to sit on a toilet.
Don't
folks.
I know that?
Yeah, I just thought like, the other people.
I tell
in the
everybody,
audience,
and they just go, "Really?"
Yeah, we're built to squat, and that opens up the tissue, and it also helps relieve pressure on the area. So I'm sorry that, despite all of your good intentions and efforts, you've suffered a complication of your pain medications. But it is a fairly common one.
Yeah.
Good luck, and I hope this heals soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're going now to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don. I've enjoyed your program over the years here, and I'm a first-time caller.
Well, you're welcome here.
Thank you. I'm calling about my cholesterol level, which is, I have a good ratio, but I'm a little high in the cholesterol. So anyway, my doctor's put me on Prevacol,
right.
And I'm taking a generic Prevacet.
Right.
I've just recently started thinking about taking red rice with CoQ10.
Okay, and you wouldn't be adding that to your Pravastatin, you would be doing it instead of? Is that?
Instead of.
Uh-huh.
That's what my question was. It wouldn't be a supplement then. It would be instead of the Prevacol.
I would never advise anyone to take red yeast rice and a statin drug together. You'd be at serious risk of overdosing on the statin. Mm-hmm. The red yeast rice does contain a statin similar to the one called lovastatin, which was the very first one discovered. That is, in fact, where the statins came from. As you may know,
that's what I understand.
Yeah, drug companies go out and look at what are the yeast making and what are the fungus making and what are the bacteria making, and can we patent any of these molecules and use them as drugs, either by extraction or by reproducing them in some other form. That's where the ideas for drugs come from, is from Mother Nature, ultimately.
So where does the CoQ10 come into it? Because I have read and been told that one should be taking a supplement of CoQ10 if you're taking the red yeast rice.
You should also be doing that, in my opinion, if you're taking any statin. Because the effect of the statin, the way it works, is to block an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, which helps make bad cholesterol. But it also makes ubiquinone, which is CoQ10, which is an antioxidant that's very important in the mitochondria of every cell in your body. The mitochondria are the body's energy factories. And in the process of making energy, you throw off sparks. And those sparks can actually damage the mitochondria and cause them to commit suicide, at which point the whole cell dies. The thing that prevents that damage is ubiquinone, and glutathione is another one. These are very important cellular antioxidants that act like buckets of cold water to catch the sparks. So if you don't have enough buckets of cold water around, you could end up damaging your cells. That would be a very slow process, very hard to detect with our current medical technology. And so it's a hypothetical issue. But I'm of the opinion that if you have a hypothetical risk and absolutely no reason to suspect that you're causing any harm by restoring CoQ10 to its pre-statin levels, makes no sense whatsoever not to use it. And that's where I'm on the CoQ10.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, so it's predominantly an antioxidant.
Mm-hmm.
What is a good dose? What's a reasonable, red yeast rice and CoQ10 sometimes come together or come separately and different strengths. What is a reasonable dose of either?
Well, of those medical authorities who agree with me on the CoQ10 matter, the generally accepted dose is about 150 milligrams. I want to add that CoQ10 products vary a lot in terms of their bioavailability, and so it's reasonable to actually check a blood level of CoQ10 to make sure that it's normal after you begin whatever regimen you're going to be on. And that blood test is commercially available. So that's a good thing to do. You might end up paying for it because your insurance company may say, oh, well, no one needs a CoQ10 level if they're on a statin. But that would be between you and your checkbook. I would still say you should do it. Now, as far as the statin is concerned, red yeast rice, most of the doses that I'm aware of are about the equivalent of 5 milligrams of lovastatin, which would be roughly equivalent to 5 milligrams of the statin that you're taking. Your doctor probably puts you on 10 or 20 milligrams.
10. Yeah. Let's see.
That's all right. We're speaking generally here.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah. So you don't want to take more than is recommended on the package. And then you want to do it for about 6 weeks. And then check blood levels of your lipids and see what you've done. The other thing I would recommend is make sure...
About 10 weeks?
No, 6 to 10 weeks.
Oh, 6 to 10 weeks,
Okay, and the other thing I would recommend is getting a high-sensitivity C-reactive protein. That's called HSCRP. This is an indicator of how badly your high cholesterol is putting you at risk.
HSCRP. And that's a test?
Yes, sir. That's a blood test.
That's a blood test, Okay. All right. I'm going to run this by my doctor.
Oh, that's just fine. I hope that he'll agree with me.
Yeah. I just am worried about long-term damage if I'm taking a Pravacol over a long period of time that I've inherited this
I got some bad news for you. Your long-term damage, as far as we know, no one's ever established that red rice yeast is any safer than the statin. I don't consider it any safer. What is not safe is running around with high cholesterol if you've got an inflamed body. Now, most people don't die of the side effects of health foods. They die of the side effects of lifestyle. And, you know, if you've got a hereditary problem and the cholesterol is high and your HSCRP is high, you've got significant risk factors that need to be addressed. Now, I'm gonna sign off and go to another caller.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Mary in Watsonville. Hello, is this Mary?
Hello, Dr. Don. Thanks for taking my call.
Hello.
I have a question. I guess I would term it under the category of doctor accountability.
Okay.
Last spring, my daughter had a rather painful surgical procedure in Monterey. So I'm a teacher. I spent a couple hours getting sub plans, drive to Carmel to pick her up, take her to the doctor. They put her gown on, wheel her into the room, put the painful IV in the back of her hand, which takes about a week for that to bruise to go away. Doctor walks in, lifts up the towel, goes, "Oh, somebody forgot to order the gizmo that I need for this. Reschedule." So back she goes, gets a clip. Now, this is a very painful procedure on her back, which, like in the days before, there's a lot of stress worrying about it. And so I take her home. She's very upset, and I had to take, again, I don't know, several days later, another day off work. There was no apology. She called the doctor's office. They blamed the surgical center. The surgical center blamed the doctor's office. And now, and some of my doctors, there's a little note that says, if you miss an appointment, we're going to charge you $50. But when the doctor's office doesn't get the right equipment, especially they don't even notice it until she's there with the IV in her hand, shouldn't there at least be an apology?
Absolutely. I hope that I'm making a true statement when I say that in my office and in my practice, if something like that happens, and it does, we basically grovel because we're sorry. And we are.
We
understand how difficult it is.
Yeah.
And I think that the physician should have apologized. And I think that you're well within your rights to be upset that you did not receive an apology because you were inconvenienced and your daughter was subjected to something painful. An IV in the back of the hand hurts. And then she wasn't able to get the benefit from that painful procedure. And that deserves an apology.
And me for missing a day of work.
I would grovel to your daughter. You would get a mild apology, but she's the one I really feel that I owe.
Well, and I suggested that maybe they could, for the second one, they could pay for someone to come and pick her up. And they said they couldn't do that because they had to have somebody trustworthy or something to drive her home afterwards because of the anesthetic.
Well, it's because of the liability.
Yeah.
Now, let me just tell you. Sometimes I've actually used staff people to drive someone to the hospital because they didn't need an ambulance and they couldn't get there, but they needed to be there. I've risked my house doing that. In our current legal situation, sometimes you do things. I once went down to Watsonville and picked a guy up at the MRI center. They had a portable MRI back then and drove him up to Dominican because he needed something that Watsonville couldn't provide, but Watsonville was the one who had the MRI that week. And it was a very bad diagnosis. And while I was driving him back up, the scenario that he would freak out and jump out of the car, cause a car accident, you know, you run these crazy scenarios because you know that you are essentially doing something that we're not supposed to do as physicians. And when you do it, it's like everything's on the line. Your license, your house, 20 years of hard work, not to mention hundreds of thousands of dollars to get to the point where you can even put an MD after your name. So, you know, people get really, really stingy with risk. And that's a problem with our culture, our medical culture. So as far as sending someone to pick her up and drive her, and I'll say this honestly, if there was a car accident and somebody from the doctor's office and your precious daughter were killed, you would sue the doctor. You would, because you'd be grieving. You'd feel that somebody needed to pay for this. You'd feel that, you know, there had to have been negligence. And the doctor's office or the surgery center, whoever did that for you, would have no leg to stand on legally. They'd just have to roll over and pay you however millions of dollars that your lawyer decided you could get. That stinks. And it leads to patients being inconvenienced, and it leads to irrational behavior on the part of doctors. And it stinks.
Are there services that will do that are bonded and licensed and insured?
There are. There are. Liftline is one in Santa Cruz County. I'm not sure what's available down in.
Okay.
You have to set it up a day or so in advance. You end up waiting an hour for them to come. Sometimes you wait an hour for them to come and get you. A taxi service is also useful, but if you need assistance getting back into the house, as it sounds like your daughter may.
Yeah.
And no, there's no compensation. Now, in other countries where they have a different system, they will pay for your ride. They have bonded services available because they understand that they're in a system, and if people can't get into the doctor and they delay, then big complications ensue. So maybe it is a good idea to pay for the taxi. But here, we have this fragmented, well, I won't even start I've already soapboxed enough on
your
question.
Well, now I don't feel so guilty about missing that second day from my class, and I'll pass on your comments to my daughter.
Let her know she does deserve an apology, and I'll apologize for the system on the behalf of whoever else was involved.
Well, and the doctor has an excellent reputation for doing surgery, and that's the most important thing. However, not so good, I guess, for groveling.
Oh, no. I mean, the higher is your status, the less willing you are to grovel.
Oh, okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So I came across this article, which I thought was just fascinating, and this is one of those completely off-the-wall associations that looks like it may actually hold water as far as cause and effect, but it makes absolutely no sense that it should. So this is a study by Kenta Yamamoto, and it was published in the American Journal of Physiologic Heart Circulation Physiology. Whoa. Not a journal I read every week. What the authors did was they studied trunk flexibility. In other words, your ability to touch your toes while sitting down with your legs fully extended. You had 500 adults, three age cohorts, young, which is under 39, middle-aged, which is 40 to 59, and older, which is 60 plus. And they looked at the arterial stiffness, which they measured pulse wave velocity. We don't need to go into that. But essentially, they looked for hardening of the arteries. And what they found was that in younger people, there was no correlation. But as you got older, there was a significant difference between your blood vessel flexibility and your ability to touch your toes. It was independent of other things like fitness, aerobic fitness, or your muscular strength. Well, you could say, okay, so the people are different biologically. The ones who have more flexible tissues have more flexible tissues as they age, and their blood vessels included remain flexible. And that sort of seems to make sense. But in a follow-up study, a different Japanese group demonstrated that if you are middle-aged or older and you take up stretching and you improve your ability to touch your toes, you actually improve the flexibility of your carotid artery, which would imply a direction of causality that I'm at a loss to explain. So I thought that was a fascinating little tidbit. And I have to tell you, tomorrow morning, I'm taking up stretching. I'm going to get down to the point where I can touch my toes. I don't think I've been able to do that for 10 years. So I guess it's stretch we go. Let's talk to Jamie in Corralitos. Hello, Jamie. We've just got a couple of minutes.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about natural estrogen replacement therapy? I'm 54 and having some problems there, and I've tried coconut oil and Astroglide and different things, but I don't want to do the regular estrogen. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
So the problems are mainly just in terms of the plumbing itself, not in terms of hot flashes and
correct.
Brain fog or things?
Correct.
Well, the plumbing can respond. The female vaginal skin in some women really thins out mm-hmm. when the estrogen levels drop. And you can use small amounts of bioidentical hormones that have been formulated to be applied to that. And I would suggest you use just estradiol because that's really the only one that the vaginal mucosa will see. And that's the one it's most responsive to. And that can be compounded. Yes, it's mostly a prescription. I think that there is an over-the-counter cream that you can buy without a prescription, but I'm not certain, and I don't think it's very potent.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably stuck with actually having to see a doctor and get a prescription. In general, I do not worry about causing any overdevelopment of the uterine lining. That is a potential side effect of systemic estrogen. And larger doses of estrogen have been linked to endometrial cancer.
Right, because my mom had died from cancer.
Well, a lot of people die from cancer. It depends on which cancer, whether there would be any risk to you at all. Some are not really very... Breast cancer, I don't think that there's any evidence that small doses of vaginal estradiol at a level to just restore the integrity of the mucosa are going to have any kind of significant level. And you could measure estrogen levels and confirm for yourself that you're not absorbing enough to raise your estrogen levels above baseline.
So ask for a test for her to measure it?
Yeah, you get a blood test, and then you use the estrogen cream, and then a month later you get another blood test, and if it hasn't popped up and your vagina's back in shape, then you have your answer.
Okay. All right, thank you, doctor.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank you for listening. It's been a wonderful and informing day, and I've enjoyed your questions very much, and I hope you'll tune in next week. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.